This is the BBC.
I'm Anushka Astana, The Guardian's political editor, and this is the Week in Westminster podcast. We're about to take you behind the scenes on the campaign trail, to delve into the polls and focus group, and to hear from a chum of Theresa May. 2 years and two prime ministers. This week marked the end of the shortest parliament since 1974. And no surprise that with an election looming, Theresa May's backbenchers were being very well behaved at the final PMQs, joining her in rolling out a polished campaign soundbite.
The strong and stable leadership.
Strong and stable government.
A strong and stable government.
Vote for strong and stable Conservative leadership.
The strong and stable leadership.
Then there was the Jeremy Corbyn approach.
I start, Mr. Speaker, with Christopher, who wrote to me this week, and he says, in the last... Maureen wrote to me this week. Sybil, Mr. Speaker, who witnessed the Labour founding of the National...
The Labour leader relaying the concerns of members of the public. Although he's got a slogan too.
When it comes to the Prime Minister and the Conservatives, they only look after the richest, not the rest. They are strong against the weak and weak against the strong.
The Speaker, John Bercow, allowed PMQs to run to double its normal length, with a string of interventions from those retiring MPs having their final moment in the chamber, one of whom got this lovely response from the Prime Minister.
Can I first of all pay tribute to my right honourable friend, my chum, in this house, over for all the service that he has given.
So before looking at the election battles of this week and ahead, let's start with that chum. The friend of the Prime Minister was Sir Eric Pickles, leaving Parliament after 25 years as the Conservative MP for Brentwood and Ongar in Essex, who rose in his time to party chair and Secretary of State for Communities and Local Government. We were also joined by Gisela Stewart, stepping down after 22 years as the Labour MP for Birmingham Edgbaston, and best known recently as the face of that successful Vote Leave campaign. First, I asked Sir Eric about the Prime Minister's choice of word.
Yeah, I should think I'm a chum. Of course I am a chum. I suspect I'm a best chum. I use the word chum far too often, and I think she was gently pulling my leg.
But yeah. You really are friends. You've known each other a long time.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Known her 20-odd years. And one time I was a deputy, worked together. She's just great to work with. Things have changed now. I mean, she's surrounded by lots of people who think they are enormously important. But when you talk to her, she's just like the old Theresa.
So many people feel they don't know who Theresa May is. Just tell us a bit about who she is. I mean, did you always spot a budding leader?
No, absolutely. She's just wonderfully normal. But by Jove, since she's become Prime Minister, I think she really has shown more than true mettle.
Gisela, speaking about friendships in Parliament, who do you consider friends? Who will you miss the most?
That's a really interesting question, because within parties, friendships are actually by far less likely than they are between parties, because on your own side, you compete with each other. But the Birmingham Labour women have been a most extraordinary group of companions. I think we have always formed a really strong group of women in the south of Birmingham. And I will miss them more than I think I realise at the moment.
When you came, you were terribly dubbed part of Blair's Babes. It's been 20 years. How has Parliament changed for women?
Now, first of all, I am still proud of being called a Blair Babe. I think that 121 women MPs, more than women had ever been in Parliament in the entire history, and 101 Labour women, I am proud of that record. I'm sad that we haven't made more progress.
Sir Eric, do you think that the increase in women changed the feel in Parliament?
Yes, for the better, for sure. When I was party chairman, I was part of the process of getting more and more women in. And what I did notice is there was an enormous glass ceiling at the executive level. But if you could get it to the general membership, on merit, women got through, and I think it's been to the betterment of my party.
Do you think there should have been all women shortlists at any point?
I came really close to doing that. I talked it through with David Cameron. And
did he want to?
I think we both kind of realise it just isn't something that a Conservative Party can do or would do. And I think, you know, we've seen that local associations can be different. But if you treat them with great respect, and if you ensure that there always are some very strong female candidates, providing you can get them to the membership, then the membership, by and large, picks them.
Can I pick you up on something, Eric, which you've just said on merit? And I would still argue that it requires more. My definition of equality, actually, is, I always jokingly said, but there's some truth, I hope, in that. When there are as many useless women in the House of Commons as there are useless men, then we have achieved equality. I still think that for women to get to the top, there aren't quite as many of the networks there. And that's...
It's true. It's harder. And generally speaking, I don't know if my male colleagues aren't offended by this, but by and large, if you look at it, most of the female MPs are better. I mean, there are some people there that are just god-awful, but... But most are pretty good.
Wonderful thing to hear. And Gisela, I just must tell people, I suppose, that I was speaking to you yesterday as part of my job, and you said to me, just so you know, if you're ringing me and a male journalist is ringing me as well, I'll pick up the phone first. There is this thing, isn't there? There haven't been the networks for women, so we look after each other a little bit more.
I think the concept of the sisterhood is kind of misunderstood in many ways. It means you look out for each other, you support each other. You don't cut down on the competition, but you just realise there is a kind of gentle support.
Sir Eric, 25 epic years in Parliament, if you don't mind me saying. You said you were very, very sorry to be leaving.
Oh, absolutely devastated.
What was the highest moment? What was the lowest moment?
Oh, the lowest moment, I think, probably would have been Maastricht. I was new in. It was a poisonous parliament, absolutely poisonous. At the time, you just didn't want to go into the voting lobby. You didn't want to talk to colleagues. It was fairly miserable. I can tell you exactly what the highlight was. It was being made Secretary of State and going for my first questions. I went to the dispatch box on the government side, put my hands on the dispatch box, and this enormous tsunami of happiness just hit me. And I just think, this is like the coolest moment I've ever had. And at that point, I looked up and I could see Labour looking at me and the Speaker was looking at me. I thought, I suppose I'd better say something.
So you wanted power. You enjoyed power.
Oh, I loved it. Absolutely. It was absolutely great.
This brutality of being in one moment and out, I think it is so healthy. And I saw the really living example of that after David Cameron stood down. And a few weeks later, I went to a memorial service. And we both arrived at the same time at the church. The only difference was that he came with security guards, but we both went into the church and there wasn't a seat reserved for me and there wasn't a seat reserved for him.
That's what I really like about British politics. One day you're a minister, you're in the ministerial jack, next day you're on the Circle Line. I think that's great.
And what were people saying to you when you were on the Circle Line?
What are you doing here?
Do they say, hi, Eric?
Where's your driver?
I mean, we were mentioning David Cameron there. Was he a chum?
Yeah, of course he was a chum. And the entire party are my chums.
Must be one or two that you weren't too sure about.
There are one or two I hate with all all my body being, but nothing would persuade
name
me. Well, nothing would persuade me.
You'd name some of the ones on the opposition benches, perhaps.
No, to tell you the truth, I'm kidding around. I've never really hated anybody in politics.
Gisela, you have just led a campaign. You've been the face of a campaign to leave the EU in the middle of a party that was really fiercely pro-EU. It must have been very, very difficult at times.
It has been really tough. And the only way you get through these periods, I think, is that ever so often, and in my case, I probably did it every morning before I went out, are you still sure you're doing the right thing? And if you can say to yourself, in my judgment, it is, then you have to just brace yourself what comes your way.
What did come your way?
Oh, I think enormous amount of abuse. And that's when I learned to say, do not watch a Twitter. Don't join them in the gutter. Always be polite. And then take comfort from the fact of how 9 months ago my inbox was full of abuse. I now find it's full of people telling me how sad they are I'm going and thanking me for what I've done.
I found that. It's like reading your own obituary. I thought, wow, I didn't realise it was this popular. If I'd known it was this popular, I would have resigned earlier.
What sort of things have people said?
I've been really nice. You know, I've been described as a statesman, all kinds of things. It's been lovely.
What have you been described for as in the past? What's the worst? How do you compare it to the statesman?
Come on. I'm overweight, bald, and I've got a silly name. You can imagine the kind of abuse I've had.
So tell me both. Why are you leaving?
I decided I would step down in 2020 on the basis I would have done 23 years, I've reached 65, and that's enough. It just came earlier. I'm sure I've got one big job in me, but I have no idea what that job is.
I can have some guesses. But just tell me, 20 years, four leaders, Tony Blair, Gordon Brown, Ed Miliband, Jeremy Corbyn.
I'm to this day an unreconstructed Blairite. I thought Blair knew that you had to change the country. He knew that it wasn't just about him, it was much wider. And he probably didn't anchor the changes sufficiently in the Labour Party for it to be sustainable.
OK, so Eric, why are you leaving?
I too had decided that I was going to stand down at the end of this Parliament in 2020. And I was always determined that I wouldn't be 70 in the House of Commons. And I just feel it's better to go when people are saying, why are you going? Than to sort of stay around and to be a point of ridicule for staying on too long.
And you don't hate anybody, but you've got to tell us, which of your leaders did you most admire?
The leader I most admired, I never had an opportunity to serve because as I joined, Lady Thatcher left the Commons and I am an unreformed, unapologetic Thatcherite.
That was Sir Eric Pickles and Gisela Stuart. Couldn't you just tell? For them, the pressure has gone. Not so for many other MPs who poured out of Parliament on Thursday and who may or may not be back in 6 weeks' time. This is a general election that Theresa May has said is all about leadership and which she will use to secure a mandate for Brexit. That has fired up the Lib Dems to be the party of Remainers, while Labour wants this fight to be about public services, the NHS, education and housing. What do the public think so far? I spoke to Joe Twyman from the opinion pollsters YouGov and to Deborah Mattinson, director of the insight and strategy consultants Britain Thinks. And I asked her, is it all about leadership?
Yes, it is all about leadership. Quite simply, leadership matters more than anything else in an election. It actually always has. Last time, in 2015, we ran a panel of voters throughout the election. They could talk about anything they wanted to do. They talked about things that struck them. At the end of the election, we added up all their comments and categorised them. And something like 7 out of 10 were comments about the personalities and characters of the leaders themselves.
Well, that's a bit depressing.
Told the story of the election completely.
Well, if that's the case then, Joe, what are the traits that people are looking for?
The idea that there's someone at home downloading a copy of each party's manifesto and then diligently looking through each one, making notes and coming to a considered decision about which party they're going to vote for just doesn't exist. I don't think it ever really existed. Instead, people take their cues from leaders about what they think about the parties. And so they want to know, can they trust this party? Is this party effective? Will this party do right for them and right for the country? And so they turn to the leaders to develop these narratives, the stories that we tell ourselves and each other about the parties in order to make that decision. And Jeremy Corbyn has not been doing particularly well up until now, in the polls at least. And in contrast, Theresa May has been doing extremely well, both in relative terms compared to one another and in absolute terms, just compared to historical figures.
Policies are also viewed through the prism of leadership as well, because people will look at the policy offer and think, do I trust this leader to actually deliver to that offer? So you have intriguing situations, take the NHS, where the Labour Party score ahead of the Tory party on trust on the NHS, but Theresa May scores ahead of Jeremy Corbyn in terms of being trusted to deliver on the NHS.
And what is it about her? I mean, I'm told, kind of seems obvious from the way the campaigns have started, but I'm told inside CCHQ, those Conservative headquarters, they're very clear, this election campaign is going to be all about Theresa May. What's so good about Theresa May in the eyes of voters?
OK, this is partly a relative thing. You have to bear that in mind. If she was up against a different leader, this might be a different story and they might be framing the election in a different way. But basically, in the focus groups, what people tell us is what they look for in a leader is strength, charisma, authenticity, a leader that can unify the country and also relatable, that can understand them. But of those characteristics, the thing that matters by far the most is strength. And she seems to have that. She doesn't particularly have charisma, it has to be said, but she seems to have strength. And given that this is the Brexit election as well, and that's how the Tories have framed it, it's worked very, very well for them because strength is what's required.
Well, they have framed it as the Brexit election, but Joe, how much is Brexit actually going to play out?
Brexit is hugely important to the public. When you ask them what's the most important issue facing the country, two-thirds of them say Brexit and Britain's negotiations with the EU. And that's well ahead of anything else. And so the question that remains is, to what degree will all the voting and people's decisions be framed by Brexit? And so will we see a realignment of British politics along the lines of the Brexit referendum vote in the way that we saw a realignment of Scottish politics along the lines of the Scottish independence vote? Now, that could be hugely important because two-thirds of Conservative voters voted to leave, but one-third voted to remain. And on the flip side, you have Labour supporters, a third of whom voted to leave. So it makes it a very difficult strategic position for both of the two main parties to address.
But I think it's a little bit easier for the Conservatives because our polling says that 67% of the public now either reluctantly or enthusiastically embrace Brexit. So even people who voted Remain are now saying, well, OK, we'll go along with it, which I think is much easier. And I think that the Conservatives have got a much clearer cut message.
And Joe, Theresa May is trying to park her tanks on Labour lawns, take advantage of this electoral lead she has got. Is it possible for her party to take working class votes?
Well, it's no longer the case that the Labour Party are just the party of the working class and the Conservatives are just the party of the middle class. And it hasn't been, indeed, for decades. Our most recent polling makes it even more interesting than that. The ABC ones, that geeky term that pollsters like me use to describe the middle class, 45% voting Conservative, 29% voting Labour. Among the C2DEs, the working classes, 45% voting Conservative, 29 versus Labour, exactly the same.
And Deborah, if that is a tie that has been broken for decades, then how does the Labour Party recover?
The Labour Party can only recover by bringing together a coalition of the kinds of voters that Joe's just been talking about, the kind of, you know, the traditional working class voters, the more progressive middle class voters. That's the only way they can win. Actually, that coalition fell apart quite a long time ago. As he's said, from the Labour Party's point of view, it started unravelling during the Labour government and been unravelling ever since. It's not just Jeremy Corbyn's fault. There's a lot of work to do.
Deborah Mattinson and Joe Twyman there, analysing the figures and the focus groups. They were suggesting that Theresa May could make inroads into Labour heartlands. But how's it looking on the ground? I was joined by two Northern politicians, Labour's Lisa Nandy, representing Wigan in Lancashire, and Nigel Adams, the Conservative MP for the North Yorkshire seat of Selby and Ainsty. First to Lisa to ask, could the Tories become the party of the working class?
There's no doubt that this is going to be the toughest general election of my lifetime, certainly my adult lifetime. People are very turned off the idea of more elections after the referendum, and so we're going to have a challenge getting our vote out. But I don't really detect any real excitement or enthusiasm for the Tories across the north. And I think part of the reason for that is actually that the cuts that started to be made in 2010 have only really taken full effect in the last few years. And it does feel like there is a growing recognition across the north that where in the 1980s we saw people on trolleys waiting in hospital corridors, we saw the rise in rough sleeping, we saw shops becoming derelict, we saw potholes in the roads, all of those things that were a feature of life in the 80s and 90s under the last Tory government, we're starting to live through again. So I think there are obviously reasons when you look at the polls for the Tories to feel some sense of optimism, but I think there are also reasons for them not to be at all complacent.
And I suppose the question I would then put to you, Nigel, is why do you think you're doing well in the polls, given the fact that people are quite worried about the NHS, they are worried about schools and cuts to funding?
Well, we are making some progress, obviously, in the north. We've just had by-election success in the northwest up in Copeland. But Lisa's right, we're not complacent whatsoever. But one of the interesting things is, I think, what people who would have considered themselves as traditional Labour voters actually do want Theresa May to now get on and secure a good Brexit deal. That's quite clear. That's a very clear message we're getting back from our canvassing. And I think they realise the only party that can deliver that is the Conservative Party.
What is your message on that point, Lisa? People in your constituency and all around you voted heavily for Brexit.
Yeah, I mean, I very much agree with Nigel that I think there are some constituencies across the country where Brexit and the anger from the Brexit referendum is still very much in play. That was certainly the case in the Richmond by-election, and I think there will be other seats like that too. But largely, the feeling from my constituents and from people I've spoken to across the North is that they are, having had that contest and having had the result, they now want politicians to get on and deliver it. But there is a reason why Theresa May doesn't want the conversation to turn onto what happens next. And that is because the sort of low tax, deregulated economy that she is proposing post-Brexit is absolutely at odds with the investment in public services and the protection for jobs and for living standards and for wages that most people across the north of England really desperately want to see. And I think the challenge for Labour over the next few weeks will be to make sure that we force that issue about what post-Brexit Britain looks like onto the political agenda, because I think Theresa May will be in real trouble.
Because, Nigel, what are you offering voters in the north in those Labour heartlands on those issues? Has the Conservative Party changed? Does it feel like a different party than it was under David Cameron?
I think we've done some incredibly positive things in the North of England. In my own constituency, I'll give an example. When I became Member of Parliament in 2010, there were 1,707 people out of work. Now, over 1,000 people now are back in work. That's just in my constituency. That's a 60-odd percent reduction in unemployment. The reality is we are making progress. We've got to remember where we were in 2010 and the financial mess that we were left in. I think we've made huge progress and we want to build on that. But you can only build on that with strong and stable leadership, which even Labour voters...
Strong and stable leadership.
You know, I'm only recounting what I've been told by traditional Labour voters.
Lisa, one thing that we can't get away from, even if you think they may be exaggerated, is that the Tories have a 20-odd point poll lead. Why do you think that is, if all the things that you're talking about are the things people are worried about?
I think there are three issues that have come up for us a lot about people's disillusion with Labour. The first, and it is of very obvious, is questions about leadership. And Jeremy comes up on the doorstep more frequently than leaders have in the past. The second question is about division. And that I think we all bear some responsibility for, is that people don't like to see divided parties. They want us to speak with one voice. And the third question, I think, is actually much more about something that has much deeper roots across the country. And that is a growing feeling that has increased over decades, that there is no political party that really speaks for people in towns across the country. And we feel that much more outside of the cities, but we have a long road to climb with that, and we've got a lot of trust to win back.
Lisa Nandy and Nigel Adams on Britain's shifting political landscape. Now, this election campaign is frankly already feeling very familiar. The robotic soundbites have been chosen, the marginal seats mapped out, and the leaders are on the road addressing crowds of party activists. And who knows, maybe even the odd member of the public. Who better to discuss the stage management than two men who know a thing or two about campaigns? Theo Bertram was a Labour special adviser under both Tony Blair and Gordon Brown. Giles Kenningham was the Tory Director of Communications during the 2015 general election. And I asked him, is it all choreographed?
Election's all about momentum versus disruption. And everything about the 2015 election was carefully choreographed. To some extent, I'd say we even worked off an acute state of paranoia in the CCHQ. We were based on the ground floor, so we had the curtains closed, so the photographers couldn't get any pictures. We had a clean desk policy as well, in case there were any moles inside CCHQ from UKIP or from Labour. And we lived in constant fear of anyone being snapped, drinking champagne or looking complacent. The fun moments are the stunts. Those are the moments when you can disrupt your opponents. I suppose during 2015, for us, that was all about reinforcing the message that Ed Miliband couldn't get a majority without being propped up by the SNP and Alex Salmond or Nicola Sturgeon. And there was always a cry which came out of CCHQ every time we knew where Miliband was speaking or holding a press conference of activate the shoal of Salmonds, and you'd get an army of activists who'd go down there with masks of Alex Salmonds or Nicola Sturgeon.
to try and ham up the idea of an SNP Labour.
Yeah, I mean, the reasons for it are twofold. One is to get under your opponent's skin, but also they make good pictures for the TV bulletins. They do reinforce a central message, so you can kill two birds with one stone.
I was a reporter during the 2015 election, actually on David Cameron's bus, so I saw a lot of this at close quarters. And it's quite interesting, Theo, because Theresa May has hinted that she's going to do things differently. I went to see her in Wales this week, and I can tell you it looked exactly the same as all those stage-managed events that we saw in 2015. Jeremy Corbyn, on the other hand, isn't the sort of man that you can easily stage manage. I mean, do you think that the Labour operation this time round is quite different to the one that you were a part of?
That's definitely true. I think that you can tell what politicians are good at because you can see the happiness on their face when they're doing something they enjoy. And actually, when you see Corbyn out on the doorstep, out campaigning, doing those rallies, he absolutely relishes it. You know, he's a campaigner. And when you look at Theresa May, by contrast, we're probably seeing one of the most hermetically sealed campaigns that there has been in recent years. In previous years, we've either had a TV debate disrupting things, throwing a PM off their stride, or we've had daily press conferences, and we don't have either of those things now.
We've seen a very clear strategy from the Conservatives in 2015 and now. Giles, was your view that actually allowing politicians to be human wasn't a way of winning votes?
I don't agree with that, but I think at the back of your mind, you've always got to have clarity of message and consistency, and you haven't got a long time to get your message over to the voters, and that is being brought into focus during this election, which is a snap election. And the thing about Jeremy Corbyn and the calculation you would make if you're in CCHQ is that he goes off message quite a lot. They have to spend a long time clarifying what he said. So there will be times during this election where the judgment call will be, do you stand back and let Corbyn carry the news cycle?
Theo, I had a text message with a senior shadow cabinet member, I won't mention who, about the idea that the Tories were going after Labour heartlands. His argument was that Theresa May would fail on that unless she was actually seen to genuinely get stuck into conversations. He said a helicopter to handpick members' meetings won't cut through. She has to go through the pain barrier of difficult conversations. And then adds, the contrast to Jeremy, sadomasochistically throwing himself in public meetings will work well for him. And they basically saying that she won't prosper if she's wrapped in cotton wool. Do you think that's true?
I think it's impossible to stay in the protective seal of the spin doctors. At some point, it breaks, you know, and that's what we saw with the Sharon Storer moment in 2001 or with Mrs. Duffy in 2010. And I think that the lesson to learn from both of those is that the more that you control your leader's image, the worse it is when you lose that control. With Jeremy Corbyn, you get the real thing. Whether you like him or you loathe him, you know, Jeremy Corbyn is who he is. I don't think anyone would ever accuse him of pretending to be someone else. With Theresa May, it feels to me that we still don't really know very much about who she is, except for what we've been carefully presented with. And I remember we did that successfully with Gordon for perhaps the first 3 months of when he was prime minister. And then at some point, it's very hard to maintain that. Now, that's hard to do in government in number 10. It's impossible to do an election campaign.
That was Theo Bertram and Giles Kenningham taking us behind the scenes on the campaign trail. That's all we have time for. The first indications of what is to come could land this week, as many people go to the polls on Thursday for local elections. That should get things going. Thanks for listening to the Week in Westminster podcast. I'm Anushka Astana from The Guardian, and we'll be back after the general election.
You can download many more BBC Radio 4 programmes for free. Find these at bbc.co.uk/radio4.